The following program contains material of an enlightening manner. Open-mindedness is advised.
Today, I want you to open your mind.
I've almost come to the conclusion that the story is so damning that the mass of people can't deal with it.
We are in process of developing a whole series of techniques to get people actually to love their servitude.
We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method.
Well, we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
To change the minds and the attitudes and the beliefs of the people of the world, and especially the United States, to bring about one world socialist totalitarian government.
The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
As you connect the dots between different people, organizations, places, religions, history, suddenly the picture starts to form. You don't connect the dots. It's just a mass of what's all this about.
The kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure.
Someone born in the United States is not more special than someone born in Mexico. Someone who is white is not more special than someone who is black. They're just vehicles for the consciousness to experience.
Brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
Humans as a species are prone to amnesia. Those who do not remember the past are doomed to repeat it. It is thus imperative that these all-important matters be thoroughly explored and not left up to blind faith.
It's about time some of you got acquainted with the real, hard truth.
What you are now experiencing is the vibration of air particles being transformed into electrical signals by your senses and DNA, then sent to the brain where they are decoded into sounds. I'm your host, Ryan Gable, and you are listening to the Secret Teachings radio broadcast. Our website, www.thesecretteachings.info. And tonight on the program, a shorter edition of the broadcast, but we will be joined by a guest, Richard Grove, here in the next 15 or so minutes. Before we get to that point, I have a few news stories to cover. And also, if you missed the last episode of The Secret Teachings or any of the past week's episodes, you can go to the website and subscribe to get access to all of those broadcasts. You can download them and stream them and get access to our Insider Video Vault through your subscription. Last week's shows included the ignorance of arrogance of the trophy culture. We also talked about allegory and parable of the ancient mysteries and the justification or the justifying of injustices or injustices in the world. And we had some other shows last week with Tolik and the Andromeda Council and, of course, the two-part series plus a special YouTube video broadcast of the Secret Teachings on the 7th of November about Podesta, Clinton, Wiener, Epstein, child trafficking, and blood sacrifice. And regardless if you are a subscriber, you can access that video on our YouTube as well as our other social media pages, Facebook and Twitter. Twitter is not used that much, but we do utilize Facebook. Facebook.com/The Secret Teachings. You can also find me and my individual host account on there under a Ryan Blank. And on YouTube, the name should be Ryan Gable, but you can find links to all of those social media pages, past shows, upcoming guests, and my books, The Grand Illusion, False Prophets, and The Persistent Illusion. It's all on the website, www.thesecretteachings.info. Here's a story I covered on Sunday. Meet Sophia, the robot that looks, thinks, and talks like a human. Now, in this story, without reading through the entirety of it, it talks about artificially intelligent robots being part of the workforce, something we've discussed before. The push for a $15 minimum wage was, at best, targeted and utilized to bring in robots into the workforce. People are losing their jobs, especially through fast food restaurants, as robots begin to take up these minimum wage jobs. And justly, people want that $15 an hour minimum wage, but don't fully understand the economic conditions for which bred that gap between the haves and the have-nots, and therefore they want more money, but don't understand the reasons for which companies cannot pay them more money. Therefore, robots are being brought in to replace these workers. Not only are these robots that perform meaningful tasks, these are robots that are artificially intelligent, and we've seen from tech magazines, universities, corporations, governments, and researchers in all of these categories, the push not just for artificially intelligent robotics, but the push for artificially intelligent robotics that are able to learn and to create, to self-replicate, and also to reprogram themselves. And that is the one key that I dug out of this article, although the claim with this new robot that looks very, very human was to develop a robot that would be able to express and recognize emotions, to learn from human beings, and to develop a connection, to develop love, not just as a sex robot, but to develop an emotional connection of love, an abstract concept that most humans don't fully comprehend or understand. And then you think of robots that are able to learn based off of human actions, and you find that it is a very, very high possibility these robots may become hostile based on the actions of humans that in some way might be innate in human nature. The one part of this article, as I said, that really stood out to me was that the researchers, the developers of this, although they say it's programmed with love and compassion to connect with children, that it will eventually be able to reprogram itself. And even then, they say, only to be able to improve skills and abilities and advance this life form's, this synthetic life form's, quote, career. But I think that's a dangerous notion, that artificial intelligence, not only can it learn and grow and self-replicate, but that this artificial intelligence can reprogram itself. That's a big red flag that we should be cautious of. Also, if you did not hear, Monsanto, which is now owned by Bayer, has EPA approval of their new herbicide, dicamba, which is widely known to be a carcinogen and may be even more ruthless than the commonly referred to glyphosate, which even reviews on glyphosate, the main ingredient in Roundup, have been delayed through regulatory agencies. And of course, it did not help or support biotech that the World Health Organization, although rewording their original stance, says that glyphosate is still a possible or a probable carcinogen. Another article I have comes from Fortune. Court rules that medical marijuana card holders can't buy firearms. Now, this one really stood out to me, and all of these stories are linked up at www.thesecretteachings.info under the top news tab. The reason this one stood out to me was because it seems very parallel to the stories of those that are on the no-fly lists and how they won't be allowed to purchase firearms. Now, for me, this doesn't even necessarily have anything to do with the Second Amendment. What this has to do with is an ability to control the actions of citizens through convincing them, as part of a paradigm shift, that new technologies, for example, even these robots and artificial intelligences, is in their best interest and offering small conveniences such as you'll be able to order pizza without picking up a phone through an application. You'll be able to have sex with a robot, which maybe is more than a convenience to some people. You'll be able to have your purchases online, items delivered with a robot much quicker and much safer than an actual postal carrier or a parcel service. Little tiny perks that seem benign, but there's always another level, another rank to what the actual agenda may be or actually is. So in this case, court rules that medical marijuana cardholders can't buy firearms. Just like if you are on a no-fly list, you can't buy firearms. It sounds benign. It sounds as if, well, if you're on a no-fly list, then you probably are a danger, so you probably shouldn't be able to purchase firearms. And yet, we have to ask the question, how do we become part of this list? Can anybody be placed on this list? What about the infants that are placed on this list? Will they never, ever have the ability to purchase a firearm or at some point perhaps any form of lethal weapon or be in possession of a lethal weapon because their name is on a list and has been since the time they were born? How do we get onto these lists? So now as more and more states move to legalize marijuana, an end game is to eventually genetically engineer the marijuana and then to essentially sell their rights to its usage or sue those farmers who have had their fields perhaps contaminated with, or somebody's growing marijuana using a farmer's field or in their backyard. Now it won't be illegal because it's, quote, dangerous. Now it'll be illegal because a company has a patent on the intellectual property of altering the genes of this particular plant. Now if you have a medical marijuana card, this court in particular has ruled you won't be able to purchase firearms. Once again, for lack of time this evening, we must ask that pertinent question of what else, in the case of no-fly lists, what else is at play here? How do we get onto these no-fly lists? Why is marijuana being pushed so adamantly, even in parts of the mainstream, to be legalized? Because the tide has shifted. And those who benefit from the illegality of marijuana have found another way to profit and benefit, whether that's politically or financially, off of the legalization of marijuana. So that is something we should be very cautious and aware about. And that's something that I will discuss in more detail as the weeks come on if that story grows and expands. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll come back with our guest this evening for the rest of the show. A shorter two-hour broadcast this evening, Richard Grove. We'll be back in just a few minutes. You are listening to the Secret Teachings radio broadcast. Stay tuned. Here at the Secret Teachings radio program, we have been banned from a college radio station for content and removed from the Keith Rowland Art Bell Dark Matter radio network for refusal to censor our content. I've interviewed the biggest, the smallest, and the in-the-middle names in the industry, along with conducting my own extensive research of hundreds of subjects in my own books. I've never sold out or stopped what I was doing because of fear for my social or physical life. I have no identifying marks and believe that balance is the only path. At the Secret Teachings, this is the real deal. From ancient mysteries to modern corruption, if you want to listen to all of my shows, great guests, and timeless subjects, subscribe for a monthly or a yearly fee by visiting www.thesecretteachings.info. Subscribe today and become an initiate to the Secret Teachings radio broadcast.
In an amazing follow-up to his first book, Author, researcher, and radio host of The Secret Teachings, Ryan Gable, has put together another massive encyclopedia of ancient and modern mysteries. Although not mandatory, Ryan's first book, The Grand Illusion, is key to understanding who controls the world and how. The Persistent Illusion explores why. In The Persistent Illusion, Ryan recaps the nature of reality and hidden history of mankind. A background on ancient holy days is provided to make us aware of the influence of certain symbols and also rituals that we participate in daily. The book exposes global practices of genocide and eugenics conducted by mega-wealthy elitists to stun and strip the willpower and soul from humanity. Are these globalists human, alien, or possessed? Ryan proposes that the global transhumanism eugenics genocide agenda may be a phase within a more complex, already underway alien invasion of Earth. The Persistent Illusion is what journalist and best-selling author Jim Mars calls an extraordinary compendium of information and a must-have for both the newly awakened and the savviest of researchers. You can find this book by visiting www.thesecretteachings.info or searching The Persistent Illusion on Amazon.com.
Thank you, Ryan. And by the way, everyone listening, I would encourage you to go get a copy of Ryan's book, The Persistent Illusion. Okay? It's lengthy, but it's got all the ammunition you need to start figuring out what's really going on in the world. This is Jim Mars, and you're listening to The Secret Teachings.
This is David Icke from davidicke.com, author of The Phantom Self and The Perception Deception, and you are listening to The Secret Teachings with Ryan Gable.
Good evening and welcome back to the Secret Teachings radio broadcast. I am your host, Ryan Gable. Our website, www.thesecretteachings.info. We are live every Saturday, Sunday, and Wednesday, 12 a.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, and 11 p.m. Central. Wherever else you may be around the world, adjust accordingly to your time zone. Tonight on the broadcast, a shorter 2 hours, but we do have a guest, Richard Grove. And I'll read a brief section of his biography, and then I will bring up Richard's volume. Richard is a corporate whistleblower, American conceptual artist, and forensic historian who frames his groundbreaking research into epic artistic representations to educate his audience. You can find links to his website and Twitter and full biography at www.thesecretteachings.info under both the guest tab and tonight's promotional page. Richard, welcome to The Secret Teachings, my friend. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing wonderful, Ryan. Thank you for the invitation and for keeping me up late so I could get lots of work done today.
Well, I heard that you already were doing lots of work today. I'm sure that you've got, what do you have, about 15 hours of work in?
Yeah, it takes a long time to do editing, and I've been, losing some of my attention in the Twitter stream of all the things that have been going on in the past couple weeks, you know, the Podesta emails. Like, when I make my schedule for the last couple months, a couple months ago, I didn't know that I'd need to spend a whole bunch of time searching up Podesta emails and, like, cross-referencing stuff, you know. So I call those unscheduled meetings, those types of things that eat up your time. But if you're using your time in a wise way, it doesn't really eat it up in a wasteful way. It's just an investment in time that you didn't plan on having to do at that time.
Yeah, that's uniquely interesting because I felt the same way. I was planning on starting work on a new book, and I was preparing to set up the show for the next couple of weeks, and obviously dealing with election debacle on both sides of the political spectrum, just paying attention. And then the Podesta email started to started to roll out from WikiLeaks, and then I invested literally days upon days upon days looking into them. So obviously you had the same type of experience. Unexpected, but you're probably glad you did the research.
Well, they're like a gift from WikiLeaks that keeps on giving.
They are. They are.
Find more and more. Like, I was about to publish a book on the history of the Rothschild family, and then there's all these Rothschild emails in there where it's basically showing that they groomed Hillary before the race even started and, you know, helped her campaign and helped her do fundraisers. And then you find other pieces where you can corroborate it. Like, I found a nice Wall Street Journal article where it talks about how the Rothschilds helped to organize $100,000 plate dinners mm-hmm. for Hillary. And I thought, wouldn't it have been such great PR for her campaign if they took that $100,000 a plate and went out and gave that money to homeless people and veterans and other people that really needed those resources? Wouldn't it have been good public relations? But no, that's not what they do, is it? They fly around in their jets and they waste a bunch of money on stupid stuff.
even
we talk about it.
even the climate conferences, the amount of CO2 that's expelled through these motorcades from presidents and prime ministers, or you know, you just have a monumental waste of money, a monumental waste of resources. As long as somebody benefits is what really matters. I was reading today about the U.S. power grid and how it would cost somewhere between $100 to $400 million to put some type of resistor on most U.S. Based power grid systems just in the United States to prevent a solar flare from wiping out the entirety of the grid. And very few, if anyone, scientist, anybody in the political arena has talked about this, because there's no money in protecting the power grid necessarily. There's only money.
There's money in rebuilding it, though.
In rebuilding it, right. So they're perfectly fine with a solar flare wiping out the power grid, I'm sure, because somebody will be paid to rebuild that grid.
You're talking about the Carrington effect. There hasn't been one of those events since like the mid-1800s, if I'm
Yeah, I think it was 1859.
Recall. Yeah, I was going to say 1849, but you're probably more accurate because you read about it today, and I read it about a long time ago.
Well, sometimes I remember things in a dyslexic fashion, so maybe not.
Well, and the other thing that people have taken into consideration, aside from losing your power grid and losing all your computers and everything that runs on any type of electronics, is that people have this copper wire running through their wooden frame houses, and you have something like the Carrington effect come along. It heats up that copper wire and starts to burn down everyone's houses. So now you have to have a plan not only to, hey, where's my Wi-Fi? Hey, how am I going to, you know, survive in nature without my artificial terrarium around me?
Yeah, that's right.
Right? So there's all this sort of stuff. So I always, I don't live in fear of these events, but I recognize that there is a certain amount of risk that comes with living life. And I keep my camping gear close to the door. So if something happens like that, I'm not totally homeless.
Yeah, and in the same way that you look and review the Podesta emails, it's not that, at least from my perspective, that we're looking for these evil deeds, Richard. It's not that we're looking for maybe sometimes for corruption. We're looking to expose corruption, but we're preparing and we're taking a moment to look at the world from a different perspective, if you will. Some perspectives that are not provided to us when we go through our typical programming through mainline education, that of which is reinforced by others around us, by family, by friends, etc.
Well, I think that first off, I had zero expectations for the Podesta emails. But what you have to realize is when you're reading the email of immoral or amoral people in small groups, very powerful, very wealthy groups, you're going to find some dirt. It's not all going to be like really happy stuff talking about, you know, look at the beautiful sunshine today and the flowers and isn't life grand. It's going to be people plotting to attain and maintain their power base. So,
especially at those high levels of influence.
Yeah. You know, and when it's, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, you know, she's been a politician for 30 years. So she's not just getting into it and getting a dip in her toe in there. Like, mm-hmm. she's up to her eyeballs in this. So,
yeah, and also,
you know, it's a real education on how the world really works and how power structures work, especially when they're hidden and kept secret from people. So I'm not really against government, but I'm against secret government. I'm against corrupt government. You know, I like the idea of being able to wake up and turn on the light switch and power comes out. I like this stuff that comes with our culture. I just don't necessarily think they're going about maintaining it in the best way. And I think that people have been kind of caught up in bread and circus a little too much. And this is, you know, so if there's corruption in the Podesta emails, it's only because we as the people haven't been doing a good job of being vigilant over, you know, who's watching the watchers is how the Iran-Contra report ended. It was the Latin for who watches the watchers. And I think that was a little nod to what's going on.
Podesta is also a counselor or was a counselor for President Obama as well. So there's another direct connection to high government there, not just somebody who's running for president, but the setting president of the United States. Then you have within the Podesta emails, you have links to so many. I mean, what really surprised you the most about reading through some of these emails?
Man, I get surprised each step I take. So, like, for instance, when the Podesta emails come up, I have this visual map of the things I've learned called the History Blueprint, and it's in this software called the Personal Brain. So I already have WikiLeaks in there. Okay, there's a new release. You know, it's not just the Hillary emails. I got to make a new thought for Podesta emails. Oh, who's John Podesta? Okay, I got to add John Podesta. Who is he? Where did he go to school? Where has he worked? He wasn't just an advisor to Obama. He was a chief of staff, man. And chief of staff, that's the guy you call to do your dirty work. It's like, get this done. You know, it's not necessarily just organizing schedules on, you know, and appointments and stuff like that. It's the, you know, if you ever watched House of Cards, you see what the chief of staff is up to in that you know, in that series, and that's painted on reality. That's why people like that and subscribe to Netflix, because they're like, they're getting a little taste of reality with a little bit of fiction in it, you know, to make it a little bit spicier. But chief of staff is a no joke position. So Podesta is not a new kid on the block. He's been out in this environment. His brother Tony is a very, very powerful lobbyist in D.C., especially with the Saudis. So it gave me the opportunity, first off, to learn, oh, who are these cats and, you know, how are they working in the Clinton administration and the Clinton campaign and this sort of stuff. And then you actually get into searching the WikiLeaks for, you know, subject words. So I searched Soros. Hey, how is Soros in these emails? Oh, wow, look at all these returns. I searched Rothschild. Oh, how the Rothschild banking family? Oh, my goodness, look at all this. Lynn Rothschild, miss you, to Hillary Clinton, XOXO. You know, and I was like, I was just... At first, it's really interesting because you're like, oh, I'm getting to, you know, see all this stuff. And then you're like, oh, now I'm getting to see all this stuff. It's like
it's a whole guy underworld.
The guy from the Department of Justice, Peter Kadzik, who is like the assistant attorney general or the deputy attorney general, some title like that, who's supposed to investigate these Huma Abedin emails and private server. He's Podesta's best buddy, man. That he's in all these very informal come over to dinner emails and, hey, this guy Kadzik is good. He kept me out of jail before and stuff like that. And I'm like, whoa, where is the like you think the mainstream media should be reporting on this? And then you realize that's the job of the mainstream media to talk about anything but this, because those are relevant facts that would have, you know, some weight in people making decisions in their lives. So they really want to keep that information away from everybody in the audience.
We saw that in the emails as well. We saw the collusion of the Clinton campaign with networks like MSNBC and CNN. So blatantly overt, once you look at the emails, it goes beyond just, you know, people have this idea, they hear shows like this, they hear people like you that say, oh, the mainstream media is controlled. And it almost becomes a catchphrase or rhetoric, but then you read it in the actual emails where they're making deals with Bernie Sanders to do and say certain things. They're making deals with CNN to ask certain questions, or they're CNN's asking the Clinton campaign, what question should we ask Donald Trump? I mean, it's corruption on a level that is only seen for those who lift the veil of the illusion of Maya.
Well, and here's what I'm going to say to people in your audience. If you think what Ryan just said there was like exaggerating or hyperbole, it's worse. Like what we are saying in these, like trying to attribute words to what we've actually read in these emails, we can't do it justice. So let me just back up a minute. Anything from the Podesta emails that I'm going to refer to, I've probably tweeted. So just check my Twitter feed. It's at Tragedy and Hope. And one of the things I was tweeting about yesterday is the New York Times came out with this article. I'm just going off the top of my head if you're searching this at home. But it was like globalism, right-wing conspiracy theory buoyed by, you know, the Trump campaign. And I was like, this is why the New York Times just lost 95% of its revenues last quarter, because they don't know which way is up. So I tweeted like 14 different tweets, like, this is why the New York Times is obsolete. And I would just include a piece of evidence with each tweet. It's like, here's a book, here's a movie, here's some stuff from, look, here's the CFR in their own words talking about globalism. Are you kidding me? Trying to make me like, they play their audience like they're dumb. And like, that's so disrespectful. So you've got this globalism idea that they're pushing. It's like, oh, it's the end of the nation state and they're obsolete and globalism doesn't exist, though, so don't worry about it. To like, you know, going through the Podesta emails, you had like representatives from every mainstream media outlet, i.e. any outlet, you know, your friends and family are probably looking at unless they're really smart. So it's like, I saw emails from the AP, and the AP dude is like, hey, Hillary Camp, what would you like me to write about you today?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they admit that they're hacks.
Yep. And you know, for all the dirt we have on Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and even the Bushes and other families, the other question arises, because I think people that didn't realize the level of corruption, the level of deceit, the level of collusion, make an argument that, well, John Podesta, even though he's directly connected, as you said, chief of staff, counselor to President Obama, and he's her campaign chair, he's not Hillary Clinton. So Clinton is only associating with him, therefore she's not involved. But then the question becomes, why would somebody of that status associate with somebody who is involved in this? In the same way of why would former President Bill Clinton be involved with Jeffrey Epstein, or why would Prince Charles be involved with the pedophile Jimmy Savile? Why are these direct connections between overt criminals and those that we can call criminals but have the protection of politics or the monarchy to cover that?
Wow, man, that's so much to unpack right there, but I'm going to try. All right, so the BBC covered up for Jimmy Savile for like 20 years, and then after Jimmy Savile, he was a very he did Top of the Pops or whatever their shows were over there. He's a host of very successful shows over like span of decades. The BBC knew he was abusing children. He had access to the royal family and all these different places where he could abuse children and hang out with these other people who did that, and the BBC covered that up. That's why whenever I see the BBC report anything about America, I take it with a grain of salt. These people don't have the same values that we do here in America. So I take that with a grain of salt. But up until the Podesta emails, that was like, that was a British problem. That sort of stuff doesn't happen in America.
Right.
Unless you know about something like June 30th, 1989, front page of the Washington Times.
Oh, those male prostitutes.
Cowboys take midnight tour of the White House, and there's like credit card receipts. And if you read the article, it says it had been going on for decades, for many presidential administrations that had been going on. Right. But maybe that's an isolated circumstance. And then you come across a book like, oh, the Franklin cover up, or a documentary like Conspiracy of Silence, and these different things start adding up about your culture. And then you see people abusing power. So the article that I would point to from the mainstream media about these recent topics would be Newsweek, where it's talking about Jeffrey Epstein and Bill Clinton and Prince Andrew and a whole bunch of other royal people. Getting together using Epstein's private jet. And when I say private jet, I'm not talking about some Gulfstream. I'm talking about like a 727 that they called the Lolita Express.
Yeah, where girls were admittedly raped on the bed in the back.
And I saw pictures today that came across The Wire. I call it Twitter The Wire. And it was like the Florida police video that goes through Epstein's house and shows all this different crazy stuff that's going on. Now, I do think this was a UK Daily Mail piece, but it's video from the Florida Police Department. So it just shows you that even though like the Daily Mail in Britain is kind of a New York Post-y, tabloid-y type of paper, you got to really read it carefully. It's the police video from Florida that nobody in the United States would really publish in the mainstream media. So you got to use these resources for what they're worth and always be, have your critical thinking hat on.
Well,
but it's a problem, and people really aren't getting a taste of it through the mainstream media at all.
And you have this separation of events, this seemingly innocuous, separate individual cases that don't seem like they're connected. So you have the Jerry Sanduskys, you have the Jared Fogels, you have the Bill Cosbys, and you have the cases of Jeffrey Epstein, and then the cases of Prince Andrew, and then you have Jimmy Savile. And again, individually, it doesn't seem like there's any collusion. And then you look at it in more detail, and you find direct connections, not just with the individuals I named, but also with former presidents, members of Congress, members of the Senate. And then this whole world, Richard, seems to open up, this seething underbelly that otherwise was hidden and obscured by rhetoric and by propaganda and by notions that the world, you know, altruistic notions that nothing is bad, that the people in power care about us. And you find this underbelly of just complete and absolute corruption is not even the word for it. I think you know what I mean. I just can't think of a word to really define or explain it. I don't think we need to confine it to a word. But it just opens up this whole world that most people didn't believe was there. And yet here is all the evidence when collectively looked at. We see what's really going on behind the scenes.
Well, and I remember like when I first started getting out of like mainstream media and looking on the internet to get information from outside of their, what I would call an Enciclios Paideia, their inscribed circle of approved information. What happens when you cross that line, when you break the chain from the dog box and you can go outside of this inscribed circle that the chain allows you to go in from the radius, and you go outside and you find this other information? You find things like, I remember watching a 7-hour interview with this woman named Kay Griggs, who was married into an intelligence official who had gone to Princeton and served with all these generals. And I remember watching it the first time because, remember, I was like, public school, public college, mainstream media. I was like, I'm not sure that I can believe what this lady's saying. And then I'd watch it every now and then every couple years. And it was probably like 10 years. And then I was like, I'd already put like a bunch of these generals that she's talking about into the history blueprint, but not from her story. So in other words, like when you hear the story, you don't know who all these names and people are. But then you get to a point of your research and you're like, wait a minute, I do know who these people, these are real people she's talking about, and she's describing them accurately. And then you start to figure out what she's saying makes more and more sense. Right. So I think what people need to do is, because when they see it in their own country, there's an emotional attachment that, oh my goodness, the president couldn't be doing these sort of things. All right, so let's just look at human nature, and let's go across the sea. There's a British journalist who's probably about our age. He was, into conspiracy and kind of truthiness and 9/11 truth and this sort of stuff. And then at one point there was this big panic because he had disappeared because he had they were having Bilderberg over in England. He'd accused Ken Clark, who was the British representative organizing it, of being a pedophile, and then this dude disappeared. And people thought it was like nefarious, like the Bilderberg guys got him. Well, I think he just went underground because somebody scared him, and he went off the radar for a couple days or a couple weeks, whatever. Anyway, he surfaces again, and then he has this meeting with British Metro Police that are like the pedophile squad for London, if I'm getting the city correct. And so he has a camera in his apartment. He has these two detectives come into the apartment, and he has like I don't remember how long it was, but it was in two videos. It's on YouTube. You can just look Ben Fellows, maybe put police video or whatever. And I checked a couple weeks ago. It was still online. And what he tells the police is from his own personal experience in working in the British film industry. And he has all these different stories, and they may or may not be true. I'm not claiming that what he says is 100% true, because how could I know? But what I can tell you is that the police tell him, oh, yeah, we know about this, these royals and all these people doing this stuff. We know about it, and we're not going to do anything about it. So regardless, so take Ben's claims and put them off to the side. What you can be sure of is the police on that tape are like, oh, yeah, we know about this. We're not going to do anything about it.
That seems to
now apply that to our country.
And that seems to be the underlying theme, is that once police or law enforcement of any level become aware of what's happening, there either is a payoff, or there is so much fear, or even outright refusal to believe that a higher authority could be involved in these types of crimes or these types of situations, dealings, whatever word you'd like to apply. You find that overall, Richard, I use Stockholm Syndrome as an analogy to explain the public's general unwillingness to believe these things for which we have documented proof, even now more than ever. Would you say Stockholm Syndrome is an accurate description for the way in which we perceive our society and our leaders?
Well, I would not only say that's an accurate description, but I once upon a time made a Peace Revolution podcast episode, maybe episode 28 or 29, that was talking about outgrowing our Stockholm Syndrome. Because basically the way I see it in the way that you describe it is, like, let's say that there's someone who works in law enforcement, because there's a lot of good people that work in all sorts of industries around the world, and their hands are tied because of the structure they're in. So let's say you've got the good cop, like a guy who's like Serpico. Do you know who Frank Serpico was from the 70s?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he was a New York City cop. He found out all the cops around him were corrupt. He tried to do the right thing. There's a whole bunch of spoiler alerts, but the way they keep a cop like that working on the force without going to the press, and if you go to the press, they're not going to print it because they're owned by other people, but it's through fear for their economic future, for their physical future. That's why they have pensions and retirements. If you talk to people in our like intelligence industry in this country, they might know this stuff's going on, but they're not going to do anything because they're afraid they'll lose their pension or their retirement. And the same for the cops, and the same for a whole bunch of other people who are supposed to be doing law enforcement. So you've got good people who are scared, and therefore they're not doing anything. And that's enabling these this very small group of bad apples. I'm hoping it's a small potent group. They're definitely potent from reading those Podesta emails. But it's a smaller group. You know, there's 300 million people in this country, and the number of people that are messing it up for the rest of us, it's not that many. And they control people through fear and ignorance. But, you know, there's a connection between fear and ignorance.
And you're able to play into people's sense of self-preservation, essentially.
Well, I think that's an old tactic. It's not, you know, it's not new to human history. And ever since, I mean, this you can trace it back to Rome or Greece or any of the earlier civilizations where, you know, the people who were managing, because once upon a time, you had to have like basically one person for one person that you wanted to control if you're using spears or swords or cages or whatever. But once they developed government and the ability to use words to control many, many people, I mean, just look at the Shakespeare's example of Julius Caesar, where Mark Antony chooses not to use logic and reason on the crowd, but to rile them up because he knows they're a crowd and he can use irrationalities and rile them up. So these are ancient tactics that are still being successfully used today because people don't read.
And you also see, even with the usage of words, if you go back to the history of the word name, the Hebrew version of the word name was a plaque that was worn around people's necks, and it denoted property. It denoted that you were somebody's property. And in the same way that in an exorcism, by naming the demon gives you dominion over it, by applying a name to something essentially restricts and gives power over to those with the ability to name that individual. And maybe in that case you could, I mean, that's a whole show in and of itself, getting into Social Security, getting into finances, etc. But just on the comment of words and how they are very, very much altered in relationship to how we perceive them or how we supposedly define them through our dictionaries, simple words like the word name actually denotes servitude, essentially.
And I'm gonna flip it around for you. Everything you just said, that's accurate. But here's the flip side of it. The word name in Latin is nomen, from which we get nomenclature. And by actually naming these things that they're doing to us, we can gain back our freedom.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool too, right?
It is.
So
when they
occult it, they use, you know, deception, hiding things. That's how they have power over us. And we can use learning to unoccult things. We can call that education. And this is how we can have a balance in a world. So there's a yin and yang to it. So that's why I try to encourage people that, well, when you learn this thing that you think, oh, that brings despair and that kind of sucks, also realize, hey, it kind of sucked not knowing that and being under control and being that ignorance that's not bliss, you know. And then so we through learning can try to, you know, go with the flow of this ebb and flow.
Well, I can give you a really good example of that. I've been an outspoken critic of what we might call the police state or the surveillance through both police, governments, just your average everyday hacker who lives down the street, and of course utilizing the so-called smart grid to carry out this abuse of privacy and abuse of what we might perceive as human rights. But if it wouldn't be for this spy grid, it is very unlikely that we would have had access to the Clinton and the Podesta and the Wiener emails to begin with. So that of which we've been speaking out against has actually led us to this information. So in that sense, it is another double-edged sword, and it benefits us if we can utilize it to our benefit.
Well, and if we look at these dichotomies as the occulted information is very dark and this other information is very light, and we put those two things together, and that's how we see. We need contrast. We need light and dark to be in
Absolutely.
Some sort of balance to see a picture. And so, yeah, the police state, yeah, that kind of sucks. And this whole smart grid deal, yeah, that kind of sucks. But if they hadn't developed all that technology, we probably couldn't be on a Skype call tonight sharing this information with people not only now, live, but next week, next month, years into the future, maybe on different planets people listen to this in the future. Who knows? Because it hasn't been developed yet. We're in the part right now where we're actually helping to manifest this, and we are determining which way we want this to go, right? So we are actually not even just like witnessing history or being spectators. We're actually participating in our own history, which I think is pretty exciting.
It is pretty exciting to sit back and think of things in that manner, a really philosophical look at the world. It's like an introspection of yourself and of society. I mean, that type of thinking alone provides a different perspective on the world, one in which is direly needed just with the general population who doesn't seem to be able to even want to think of these more abstract concepts and only wants to be numbed by entertainment and by drugs and by alcohol and anything that can remove them from having to take any sense of responsibility for their actions or for the actions of the society as a collective whole.
Well, and that's part of the welfare state, is they want us to – so we've been slowly getting groomed over the past several decades, maybe even the last century, to have less and less self-reliance, be less and less self-responsible, get more and more of our self-esteem from things that we buy with money instead of things we can learn or do for ourselves. And what you see is that government is growing stronger. They are taking upon themselves to do all the surveillance. We don't need to, like, talk to each other. They'll just, you know, like, they don't need to even put spies next to us anymore like they did in the gulags of the Soviet Union. They had to have human beings doing that. Now they got us carrying around these things in our pocket that do
That's
all the
right.
spying for them. And so I was just looking at these tweets tonight from a whistleblower named Thomas Drake, who let me step back for a minute. He happened to be at the time when I was looking at his tweets tonight, talking about how, you know, we've moved into this celebrity culture and it's, you know, merit and like what you actually do doesn't matter. And it's more about celebrity, which is kind of a shallow, hollow, you know, state of being. And so I tweeted at him. I said, you know, there was this quote that Karl Rove dropped during the election the other night, which was from a Rhodes Scholar in 1962, Daniel Boorstin, who was later a Librarian of Congress. And he said in 1962 in this book that talks about how they basically create fake news through press conferences and stuff like that for the president. And he was like the shaping of PR for presidents. The quote had to do with, you know, in the future, it won't be your experience or statecraft abilities or anything. It'll be your ability to be a celebrity. And so Karl Rove, who, like, I don't really like Karl Rove, but I do respect his intellect because he's a smart dude. I just don't necessarily like how he uses his intellect, but, you know, to each their own. And so he's laying out this quote. I could say, oh, Karl Rove, I don't like him. I'm not going to listen. Or I could say there's some wisdom there to be gotten. So I got the Daniel Boorstin book. I was studying that quote. And so he has these other quotes, Boorstin does, about hope, celebrities and heroes. Well, a hero makes himself and he does it through his actions. And celebrities are kind of just, they're famous because you know their name, right? And so I was thinking that's pretty ironic because here's Thomas Drake, a hero in my book, someone who got charged with the Espionage Act for being a whistleblower because the company he was working for, the National Security Agency, was spying on people and violating our rights. And if government's supposed to do anything, it's supposed to secure our rights, not keep us safe or any of this other stuff they try to use the budget for. And there's Drake working in the Apple store now, right? So here's a guy who should be, like, you know, making the money of a president, and he's working in the Apple store. And you got this guy who's a president who's famous for firing people who ran fake businesses. Now, isn't that ironic?
It seems that heroes become vilified and villains become heroes in this new inverted reality that we live in, Richard.
Well, I think that's the way that they maintain reason upside down. That's the way they keep it, like, upside down and capsized.
And you had William Binney on the show, right?
Well, I didn't have him on the show, but I did. I wanted to interview him for a film I'm doing. I'm still working on the film, but I did the interview a year or so ago. And so I contacted him because I knew another talk show host that knew Bill Binney. And he said, oh, I can hook you up with him. So I got his email. I said, hey, Mr. Binney, I'd like to interview you. And here's where I'm at and where are you? And, I'll come down to you. And he said, it's easy. I'll just take the train up to you. And so then I rented a place and we set up our camera equipment a day before because there was a whole bunch of stuff to set up. And so he was here in Connecticut. We interviewed him for it was a 7-hour day. We probably got 3.5 hours of solid footage out of it. And what I do in my interviews is I just see so many people trying to get sound bites and that's it.
Oh, yeah.
And I just want to get, like, what was your whole motivation? Tell
substance.
Me everything you know and capture it for history and memorialize, like, this guy's body of work. Tell me exactly, you know, how did you get started and what did you do and what does it mean? And, you know, I'll sit there for days. Like, I interviewed John Taylor Gatto, who's a famous educator from New York City, New York City School Teacher of the Year, New York State School Teacher of the Year, who wrote the book Underground History of American Education. I interviewed him over 2 days. I interviewed another gent down in Florida last year who held one of the top, the highest security clearances in the United States or British government. And he was an attorney for the Department of Justice. He was a Nazi hunter. He found out, you know, who brought the Nazis back to America and a whole bunch more. I interviewed him for like 5 hours. So I'm not scared to, you know, write an outline over a couple of weeks, reading every book the person's written, take a bunch of notes, and just really get it down on tape. Unfortunately, it just takes me a long time to edit that sort of stuff, so it's kind of slowing the cranking out. But
I bring William Binney up, and we actually have a call here in just a moment, and then we'll take our first break. Tonight's only 2 hours. If you're just tuning in, we have Richard Grove on the program. I'm your host, Ryan Gable. I brought William Binney up because I had him on. William Binney, one of the highest-level national security agency whistleblowers, and he said to me, which he said to other people before, the whole point in this surveillance, yeah, there's aspects of corporations cashing in on knowing what people are doing and what they want to buy through advertising. There's different levels to this, but at the very final conclusion, the end goal is, quote, population control. If you want to comment on that very briefly, then I have a call I'd like to bring up.
Yeah, what Binney means by that is not necessarily eugenics, although that is a factor and it's in play. But from the national security side of things, where they're collecting all this information, they want to control human beings. And human beings are hard to control if we're all thinking for ourselves. So that's why the, you know, the mass media then meshes into that to take us down to our lowest common denominator and put us on stimulus reaction without any thinking between that stimulus and reaction. Go ahead.
All righty. 1-208-650-4160 is the number to call in. Richard Grove, our guest this evening. And I have a separate Skype open, so hopefully this works properly. I have, I believe, William on the line with us, otherwise known as Payday Monsanto. William, are you there?
Hey, gentlemen. What's going on? Great show. Interesting. I'm so glad that you're talking about this. And there's a bit of an echo, so I'm just going to, you know, speak a few things and hang up and listen more because it's very interesting. But, you know, the Soviet spy device is in your pocket. And I always say that, you know, people are walking around with the very thing and they're building the very thing in various instances that are going to and that are currently enslaving them. And there's been a transvaluation of values. There's been a transvaluation of everything. Of so many things, you know. And with this latest wiki pizza party spirit cooking Podesta thing, this echo is kind of rough, but it's interesting because I know those who have looked into this for a period of time are not surprised at all, and we shouldn't be. I mean, which is surprising is perhaps the fact that it's out there in the open for everyone to see if they wish, right?
Sure.
You know, and we can use the FBI's own resources to implicate these reprobates a dozen times over. You know, there's just so many aspects to this. It gets confusing and people cannot believe it. They look at you like you have three heads when you talk about this type of stuff to them. And I'm sure you can relate.
Yeah, the overwhelming nature of the information seems to be what prevents people also from understanding it on top of the Stockholm Syndrome.
If I might just jump in there. William, do you plan on changing your Skype handle to Payday Bayer, since Bayer bought Monsanto? No, it's a rhetorical question, man. You heard the echo?
No,
welcome to the world of broadcasting. It's tough, isn't
yeah,
it?
You know what I plan on doing, though, is campaigning these the Monsanto people who are trying to get me on copyright claims since there's no more Monsanto.
Oh, that's happening now. Interesting. You'll have to tell me about that later.
All right, so I wanted to, that was a really well-worded question.
Yeah,
if I could
use my
just
name
address. Yeah, I just wanted to address how you talked about like the Russian spy device in our pockets, right? So that's interesting because I have a book by Zbigniew Brzezinski called USSR or USA Divergence or Convergence. It's something of that title. You can find it on Amazon. He wrote it back right around the time they're forming Trilateral Commission. And basically what he says, because, you know, he came from like the Soviet bloc in Poland and he was studying East Germany and he's trying to figure out. So basically one of the quotes he says in there is that the Russians were able to collect massive amounts of information on their people, but they lacked the computing power to process it and make any, you know, make heads or tails of it to make it useful to them in controlling their population and their population control. And so immediately after Brzezinski makes these observations, I'm not saying this is causal. I'm just saying as soon as Brzezinski prints this book, the NSA and all these other groups start doing mass surveillance and building computer technology and advancing computer technology such that they can collect massive amounts of information on people, process it, and then get it into our pockets where we are doing the work and processing for them. And it's all like outsourced. So when you read the words of Brzezinski, I think he wrote it in the early 70s, this book, USSR. Look, I could turn around and find it, but it's USA or USSR, Divergence or Convergence. Brzezinski didn't write that many books, so it'll be easy for you to find. You can just look at this plan roll out over decades, and you see that everything that you were just talking about is accurate. And then as far as what you find in the Podesta emails and that whole sort of investigation angle, that's brought to us by all that that surveillance technology that they aimed on us. They forgot to make themselves immune from it. And that's what Hillary was trying to do with her private server. So just jumping back in my timeline, when I blew the whistle in 2003 for Sarbanes-Oxley, Sarbanes-Oxley was a government mandate, a congressional mandate for corporations and political organizations, all these different organizations, to keep all their email in an archive so it could be audited by the SEC, the IRS, the FBI, whomever. And so what Hillary is doing with the private server is taking herself and all of her communications outside of that audit trail, which makes it outside of the FOIA abilities. It makes her unaccountable. And that brings me back to with Podesta and all this stuff that you're finding in these archives. Yeah, we shouldn't be surprised, but I'm always shocked. I'm always shocked what like the depravity that these people get up to. And I'm also shocked at the openness and the like the candor that they're just expressing like what they're doing and how they're doing it and whatnot. And it gets back to the question, like, who will hold these people accountable? Because the people in government, like, they do all that stuff for blackmail.
Yes,
there was
a
famous CIA operation called Operation Midnight Climax, where they would basically have hotel rooms and hookers and two-way mirrors and like film cameras and microphones. And they'd be dosing people with LSD, like corporate guys, politicians, whatever. And, you know, that's not new to the 60s or 70s because Alan Dulles had gotten caught in a honeypot back in 1916 and been an agent for the British government because he got caught having sex with somebody who was trading secrets with the enemy. So this goes on in the past in various forms because of lesser technology. But what they're doing today as far as the digital archiving and stuff, like what do you think Epstein's Island is? It's a place to make blackmail, and blackmail leads to power in their world.
And that's
so
why these very
William, that was a really good question. Thanks for calling, man.
I think William disconnected. He had a bit of a delay and issue on his end, but I know he can still hear us. So thank you, William, for the call. And you're right, it is about blackmail. You hear stories about congressmen, senators, people, and even corporations. You get invited to a party, election after the election, you go to the party, and I think this was part of the Franklin scandal book that you mentioned earlier. In the book, they were talking about how these high-level political leaders would be brought to a party. They'd come in thinking it was very benign, it was just a social gathering, and then they'd find a naked 8-year-old girl who's being fooled around with by some fat pedophile, and they snap a couple of pictures of you with this girl. Or in other cases, you have those that are actually attracted to children. And I mean, a good case of that, I think, would be Dennis Hastert, former Speaker of the House, who abused young boys at a younger age when he was at a younger age, and then he becomes Speaker of the House. He's easily blackmailable and controllable to be put into that position of power so high in the government to be essentially second in line to be president.
Well, I'm not saying this to be slanderous or libelous, but I recall also a congressman or senator, Barney Frank, that was running his lover was running a brothel out of his house and stuff. So there's like all these various layers. But what you notice is like, that, you know, beyond the specificity, if you want to get to the general pattern, the more crooked and, you know, you are, the more handles you have on you for people to control you. And therefore, the higher you're going to rise in government.
That's right. And just like the security, just like the spying, everything seems to be so multi-leveled, Richard. You have the levels of spying that are simply for the selling of information to make money. You have the levels of spying for insider trading, which obviously is about making money, or advertising to people specific, well, what they think they need, but is really what they want. It's an artificial need. And then, of course, you have different levels for which there is what William Binney said, population control. For pedophilia and through the Podesta emails and child trafficking and the Vatican and the royal family, et cetera, you have these You have these people that are actually attracted to children. You have others that abuse children because they can, because they, it's like a power trip to them. And then you have others that do it because they're forced into it for blackmail, just like the mafia does. When you become a made man, you have to commit a crime, and then it's documented, and then they have dirt on you in case you try to rat out the organization. I mean, what we're dealing with here, I think, is a really good example exemplified by a mafia-style form of governance, if you will. Does that make sense?
Well, only if you take the mafia as any type of secret society that has existed for thousands of years, because aside from some of them that don't do that sort of thing, that's kind of the status quo. I mean, you can even look at, you know, the ancient forms of masonry and say, whoa, that looks a lot like a safe house system, you know, where they've got these rules where you can stay at a brother's house, but you can't be doing anything with his wife or kids or anything like that because you're on the run from someplace else. It seemed like a liaison network for criminals back in the day, just from one angle, not the esoteric angle. I'm just talking about, you know, the physicality of it and how they have different places set up for people who have passed their tests of initiation. And there might be outer circles to that, and there might be inner circles to that. And so there's all this nuance that you're not getting exposed to through public school or public college or mainstream media. And this only comes through like reading books and talking to other human beings who have read books and done things and gained experience. But this is what you see in the gangs, like, you know, Bloods and the Crips. They have initiations to get in the gangs. So that's not a whole lot different than the mafia. And then, there, you know, you get the Irish mafia, the Sicilian mafia, the Jewish mafia. Those groups, like, they didn't just invent those techniques of controlling each other and keeping people in check and having a power structure. These are ancient ideas. And so now, even just by looking into any of that, you're looking into the history of the world. You're actually learning more about the world around you. These are good things. So it's you know, ominous, I think, if you're subject to all this and you don't know anything about it. Like, when I grew up, you know, in Western Pennsylvania, there's not a whole lot of obvious mafia activity. So you think The Godfather, oh, that's just a movie. You don't realize, no, the movie's made from reality, and it's mirroring going on out in reality. Then I learned as I got older, it's like Boardman, Ohio was like maybe 45 minutes, an hour from where I grew up. Well, there was this family out there called the DeBartolos, and people would be like, oh, they're into mafia. And I was like, whatever, that doesn't mean anything to me. But then it's like, oh, they own the San Francisco 49ers. They own these different sports teams. They own these different shopping centers. And then as you get older, you're like, oh, that's what organized crime is. It went corporate.
Which is what the Clinton Foundation is organized crime. They masquerade as an altruistic entity, and yet behind the scenes, that is where they launder money. That is how they are able to pay people off. They have used the Clinton Foundation to rape and pillage nations, countries like Haiti. It is a very sophisticated form of organized crime at the highest levels that seems to be unprosecutable.
If one were to just Google or use a search engine and say Clinton Foundation scandal, you'll see things from reputable, if there is any sort of reputable mainstream media out there, you know, they're saying things like, oh, it's a crime syndicate. It's not even a foundation. It's a front for a crime syndicate. There to launder money. In fact, there's a Wall Street Journal article that I'm fond of where they're like, hey, it's the U.S. Department of Clinton, and that the State Department and the Clinton Foundation were one seamless entity. That's like the highest crimes you can commit in this country. And I have a feeling that her server was serving up more than just national secrets and classified information.
Yeah, see, that's where they try to focus the attention. They try to focus the attention through the media on the fact that, oh, she may have endangered national security. She had a private server. You know, that's a felony that she deleted the emails. But that's what you really should focus on, not what was in the emails, just that she had a private server. That seemed to be the
general consensus. Well, and not only that, one of the things I tweeted the other day was like 10% of the emails sampled by the Justice Department of Hillary's emails, 10% of the emails sampled, which she gave them 40 emails to sample. 10 of those had classified information.
Yeah.
Four of them. It was 10%. But I tweeted the actual document. You can read it from the Department of Justice. This is their finding. This is not my opinion. So that she's like, I can't even find 40 emails that don't have classified information. She had 40,000 of them, plus another 30,000 that she deleted that she said were about yoga meetings and her daughter's wedding. Well, when you get into her daughter's wedding, you're like, oh, she deleted personal emails about her daughter's wedding. I understand that. No, you don't. Because the Clinton Foundation was paying like $25,000 for Vera Wang wedding dresses and all this other. Yeah, of course. That's she right. Doesn't want people to know about that, because then they realize, wow, these people who left the White House broke now have hundreds of millions of dollars, and they live a very different lifestyle than the rest of us. We cannot relate to someone like Hillary or someone like Bill Clinton.
Yes.
As an individual in this country, there's no even those people that support them, if they hung out with them for 48 hours, you would find yourself like beside yourself because you're not like them. They're not like you. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that it is what it is.
Yeah, there's very little, if any, relatability. And that's why they try to focus on subjects that are very mundane, that are very easy to understand, and especially social differences, whether it's women's or minority rights, because those are situations that you can address based on something that's physically visible, somebody's skin color, somebody's nationality, where they might have different looks, somebody's sex, depending on their sex organs. Those are things that are so visual, and that's just politics in general. That's how Republicans, that's how Democrats, and all other political affiliations work. They target those very simple social categories because that's what people tend to care about. Usually it's only what's visible on the surface, what they can see, taste, touch, feel, and hear. And so that in and of itself, as you said, even a few minutes ago, that is another form of control that has been understood for a very long time. You could even throw into the mix here, before we take our break, Madison Avenue, 1920s, Edward Bernays, and being able to understand the targeting and also the neuro-linguistic programming of people and how they shop and how they buy products by targeting their centers of emotional reaction through stimuli that you place in advertisements instead of their sense of reason. So you don't look at this item and say, well, I actually need that. You look at this item and say, I want that. And then that want becomes an artificial need. And that has been applied to politics and all other areas of social control, I think. Comments, and then we'll take a quick break, Richard.
All right, so back in the day, back in the times of the Greeks, the Romans, politics actually meant the relationship between the individual and the whole. Today, identity politics is just politics. It's all about labeling yourself as something, you know, more specific than a human being. And I say, as soon as we start saying, I'm more than a human being, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, I'm whatever, you know, you go by skin color, religion, whatever, that is divide and conquer. So don't attach those words to you. To label yourself is to negate your best aspects and hide them from other people. In addition to Bernays and his book Propaganda back in the 20s, you've got Walter Lippmann, who wrote Public Opinion. Either read the first couple pages of Bernays' Propaganda or read Walter Lippmann's definition of public opinion, and you'll see that these people have been playing us for almost 100 years without people even like realizing what's going on. And the other component that you threw in there about the, you know, the need for conspicuous consumption and these sorts of things, that comes from a guy named Thorsten Veblen, who said, look, if we want to control people, we can't have them being self-reliant and having all their self-esteem from what they can do and what they know. We need to get them to externalize it and get it from these external things, these products, which Bernays and Lippmann and Ivy Lee and these other guys were all too happy to convince people they needed. And through that, that indentures us to this big corporate culture where we need a bigger car and bigger house, keep up with the Joneses and all these different things. So that kind of just left unchecked is what we have here today. We have a culture of people that feel that they have entitlement because they're getting more and more used to this welfare state, which matches up with the increase in despotism and tyranny that we're seeing with our government. And the only way to take it back is to learn how to be more self-reliant, build real self-esteem by actually doing the reading and doing the work and asking the questions and finding the answers ourselves. Break.
Richard Grove, our guest this evening. You're listening to the Secret Teachings radio broadcast, tragedyandhope.com, one of his websites. Richard, is there any other social media or any other websites that you would like to promote before we take a break?
The only social media I use is Twitter, and it's @tragedyandhope.
Twitter, @tragedyandhope, and tragedyandhope.com. Richard Grove, again, our guest. We'll be back in just a few minutes. You are listening to the Secret Teachings radio broadcast. Stay tuned. Here at the Secret Teachings radio program, we have been banned from a college radio station for content and removed from the Keith Rowland Art Bell Dark Matter Radio Network for refusal to censor our content. I've interviewed the biggest, the smallest, and the in-the-middle names in the industry, along with conducting my own extensive research of hundreds of subjects in my own books. I've never sold out or stopped what I was doing because of fear for my social or physical life. I have no identifying marks and believe that balance is the only path. At The Secret Teachings, this is the real deal. From ancient mysteries to modern corruption, if you want to listen to all of my shows, great guests, and timeless subjects, subscribe for a monthly or a yearly fee by visiting www.thesecretteachings.info. Subscribe today and become an initiate to The Secret Teachings radio broadcast.
We have been conditioned to conform to what is popular, conditioned to accept what is considered normal, and conditioned to repeat what we are told is the truth since birth. It's time to stop, cast off the shackles of perception, and empower ourselves. A great place to start is by listening to the Secret Teachings radio program hosted by Ryan Gable, airing multiple nights live from the occult and alternative history to health and the paranormal. For more information on content and airtimes, visit www.thesecretteachings.info. That's www.thesecretteachings.info.
Radio host and author of The Grand Illusion and The Persistent Illusion, Ryan Gable has assembled a close examination of religious history and tradition that parallels both institutional religion and pagan rituals, and to expose the darker side of modern religious practitioners who scoff at their pagan roots. In False Prophets and the Lovers of Children, Ryan details a worldwide network of narcotics, weapons, and human trafficking from presidential bloodlines to Buckingham Palace and the Vatican. Other subjects include conjuring and the origins of communion, all the while attempting to bring balance back to the world of male and female symbolism. Author and activist Kevin Annett describes this book as one everyone must read. You can find False Prophets and the Lovers of Children by visiting www.thesecretteachings.info or searching for False Prophets and the Lovers of Children on Amazon.com.
Winston Smith over there.
You're just the man I was looking for. What can I do for you?
My mic's so hot.
What do you do, sir?
My mic's so hot.
Big Brother is watching you.
There is no way of knowing when the thought police might plug in on your wire.
This mic device is nice.
Yeah.
65% titanium.
Two plus two.
45% plutonium.
Equal five.
My mic's so hot, my fingers burn.
Even if I never put the pen to paper?
Every time I go to grip up by your neck, taking my respect, baby, they will learn.
I have committed thought crime.
I can't lie, it's no big deal.
And for that, they're bound to get you.
It's just in my nature to take you to places and give you funky flavors you can feel.
Sooner or later, but they'll get you.
They wanna interfere with my flow.
You simply disappear.
Cause they know what's gonna happen. I get my plan in action. I make the population psychos.
Always during the night.
Let the thought criminals be heard.
You were abolished, annihilated, vaporized.
See, I'm committing a crime by just spitting these rhymes and reading betwixt the lines they blur.
Your name removed from the register.
Thought crime. I get it all of the time. I told my mom, she said, relax, it's all in your mind. And mom's was right 99% of the time. But this time, my word is superb, it's sublime. Thought crime, I get it all of the time. I told my mom, she said, relax, son, it's all in your mind. And mom's right 99.9% of the time. But this time, my word's superb and sublime.
Ouch! Even the names of the four ministries exhibit an impotence in their deliberate reversal of the facts. The Ministry of Peace concerns itself with war. The Ministry of Truth with lies. The Ministry of Love with torture. The Ministry of Plenty with starvation. These contradictions are not accidental. They are deliberate exercises in double think.
I'ma have to strictly speak about the things I know to be truths, opposed to what you saw on the news. The map they give you is designed to get you lost and confused without a clue as to what's going on. You a frog in the pot, and the water's getting warm. You better jump like crisscross before you get boiled, sauteed, broiled, pureed, turned into fish sauce. Big brother watch ya with enhanced binoculars. Sneak and peek, it's all standard like Sinatra.
War is well rehearsed like the opera. Behind the scenes footage, take four. I gotcha. Locked in the Orwellian state with your celly and mate. Trying to get some jelly from grapes. Cause they've erased the taste of the wine from your mind's memory. And replaced it with swine energy. I got news for y'all. The world is round. And 2 + 2 = 4. Thought crime. I get it all of the time. I told my mom, she said, relax, it's all in your mind. And mom's is right 99% of the time. But this time, my world is superb and sublime. Thought crime. I get it all of the time. I told my mom.
Welcome back to the Secret Teachings radio broadcast. I am your host, Ryan Gable. Our guest this evening, Richard Grove. His website, tragedyandhope.com. Our website, www.thesecretteachings.info. That song there, Thought Crime, by our previous caller, William, a.k.a. Payday Monsanto, a great hip-hop artist from the underground scene, if we may call it that. Richard Grove, we were talking about a wide variety of subjects, bouncing back and forth between topics, but in this final 45 minutes, as we have a reduced broadcast this evening, what is it that you would like to address? What is pressing on your mind this evening?
Well, I'm pretty impressed with William's linguistical talents there, man. I was digging that song, and then to know that's the guy who called in earlier, I feel honored to have been part of that conversation. One of the things I wanted to point out is if you're on social media, like I said, I don't use Facebook because I don't like to be used, but on Twitter, there's this I don't know who it is who posted it, but their handle is at Fear Department. That's the U.S. Department of Fear, and whoever does that that profile has a weird, like, talented way of taking these all this messed up information we're being exposed to every day, all this this fear, and reflecting it back in such a way that you can laugh at it. And I think that once you can understand something to the point where you can laugh at it, it gives you a certain power over it. In fact, it disconnects you from that fear power that it had over you. And so I like to, you know, just a couple times a day, see what they're tweeting out so I can, you know, keep my feet on the ground, keep a smile on my face, and keep moving forward and growing in a light direction. So that's just a little plug for somebody. I don't know who they are out there, but they're pretty witty. And if you could use a couple more, you know, chuckles in your day without losing any substance, that's a great way to do it. As far as stuff that I want to talk about, I'll leave it up to you, man. Like we dipped in, we put our toe in the whole Podesta emails a little bit. I'll just I'll hit the ball across the court here. I started looking into it like generally, and then I saw some stuff where I was like, man, people are making stuff up now. You know, I saw the picture from the UK Guardian where they had the what they called the e-fits, but it's like the digital sketch of these criminals. And I was like, somebody's playing a practical joke, and they're making Podesta and his brother look like these sketches or whatever. So I was kind of incredulous, and I was like, I'm going to go search that up. Is that a real article? And then I started learning about Madeleine McCann, who was a little girl who got stolen out of Portugal. And sure enough, from 2003, in this article on The Guardian, the e-fits or the police sketches, they looked a lot like Tony Podesta and John Podesta. Now, I'm not saying that's anything criminal that they look like these dudes over there. I mean, if you look at the guy who played C-3PO, Anthony Daniels, he kind of looks like one of the guys in the sketches too. So I'm not making any type of certainty out of that. I just thought, wow, I thought that was totally fake, and it's not. That's a real sketch of, they say in the article it's one person, but it looks like it's two people.
Yeah.
And when you look at those two sketches, and then you look at it next to the Podesta brothers, there is a striking similarity. And I didn't dig too deep into it because I dug enough to be like, well, even if it's going on, like, what are we going to do about it right now? You know, it was right around the time of the election. It's like they're not going to obviously Trump's not locking up Hillary or appointing anyone to be like an investigator right now because he's like, oh, these are great people and I'd never do anything to hurt them. And so it just makes me think that, like, you know, I knew he was friends with the Clintons the whole time and that maybe his job was just to make sure that people like Jeb Bush or Rand Paul or anyone else that was out there is just like off the list. You know, he kind of went after them at the beginning of the campaign and then like he had it easy peasy all the way up through the finish line. So maybe there was some deal cut back in the day where like if he doesn't bring this up about Hillary and she doesn't go to jail, then he gets to be president. I don't know how these things work. All I know is that once I started digging into the Podesta emails and I found Soros and one of the Rockefeller wives, she's in there like, hey, I'm one of your big funders, and here's what I want for this policy. And she's basically just handing down marching orders. And I've always known that that's kind of how it works. It's like the politicians that we see are the proxy level layer between the people who are really running things and us.
Yep.
And so they kind of have this proxy layer called government. And you think, oh, the president, he's the most powerful guy in the world. No, he's not. Like, he's the tool of the most powerful people in the world. Because the most powerful people in the world don't have to go to work every day in the White House and go to these meetings and travel all over these places, you know? And we think of it as like, oh, that's a privilege to be the president, when really it's a whole different, you know, ball game than you think is going on.
Whereas even when you see the Forbes, what, 50 richest men or 50 richest women, you always see someone like Bill Gates at the top of that list. But there's never a Rockefeller or a Rothschild or any of these other big families. There's never a name like that included in the list. And these people are infinitely more wealthy.
Oh, but there is. There is. Okay, so that's what people say, right? There's a list called, I think it's the Forbes Dynasties, where they have the family dynasties ranked.
That's a different one, though, compared to the wealthiest, though, right?
Well, it is and it isn't. Like, the wealthiest, they'll be like, oh, Bill Gates, the wealthiest guy in the world. And what they do with the dynasties, because the dynasties one is where the Rothschilds are listed, where the Rockefellers are listed, where these big family fortunes that have been kind of divided up between a bunch of people in the family. Like, even the Rothschilds, it's like, what they ever list in one of these magazines is nowhere near what their holdings are. And that doesn't even get into, like, the British royal family or the Vatican or any of these other multi-hundreds of years statecrafty type of places. But, you know, it's a stepping stone to get to that level. It's like, once you see that the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Flemings, like Ian Fleming's family is a banking family. His grandfather was an opium banker, a Scottish opium banker, and they're worth billions of dollars. And one of the companies back in the day that used to do a bunch of the opium brokering was called Jardine Matheson. And they recently, in the 1970s, I think, merged with the Fleming's Bank, Ian Fleming's family bank, and now it's called Jardine Fleming's, or Jardine Fleming. So these are like, there's a continuity of these power structures, but they're all behind the scenes. You never hear about them, because what you hear about is, oh, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton or John Kerry, you know, John Kerry flew to Antarctica and used up enough CO2 emissions that you'd use in a whole year. You know what I'm saying? Flying his big plane down there. It's like, that's all, like, that's there. It's like the clouds to block you from seeing the rest of the sky behind it.
Sure, sure. Well, that's what I've said about corporations that promote green agendas, and sometimes these are corporations that, one, pay no taxes or have very, very rigid tax breaks and tax cuts, or corporations that have the ability to operate their facilities with essentially no oversight and cause more pollution than you will in an entire lifetime, and yet they are at the forefront. Kind of like, again, the mafia and the Clinton Foundation acting altruistic, trying to promote this idea of green. We want green initiatives. We want to protect and save the environment. Meanwhile, these are the people that are destroying the environment. And although we can have a discussion and a debate about climate change as opposed to global warming, as opposed to these ridiculous draconian laws and possible taxes that are being implemented, there is destruction of the environment from corporations, and the actions that these people take are far worse than the collective whole of modern society, not just from the items we use, but from our daily lives, what we call a carbon footprint. These people pollute and damage the environment far more than we as individuals are responsible for, and yet these green initiatives are to force us to pay for their actions, it seems.
Well, I'm going to take this all over the place for you, but you'll be able to follow real easy. They're trying to take us to the underworld. Back in the day, the green man, that was Osiris, right? Trying to take us to the underworld and steer us through there. Well, this is what they're doing. The green agenda, like, even if you want to say, let's just start out with the skeptic's view, the opposing side. Global warming is a man-made, it's anthropogenic. Okay, let's say it is. It's not created by me or Ryan or you listening at home. It's created by these people who run these multinational corporations with these huge, like, oil tankers and all these other things that do more pollution in a mile than we do in our whole lives. So it's not because of the individuals if it's being done like that. So, like, and those things don't have to be done like that, because we're stuck on a petroleum standard that's artificial scarcity, because we could be growing hemp, producing ethanol, producing clean energy, but there's no profit in that, because you could grow that stuff in your own yard. You need to be beholden to these people that have the monopoly on the artificial scarcity of this, you know, black gold Texas tea that's only found a couple different places in the world where they're always fighting, basically, right? So you have to understand that the people that are in power, they have different ways of holding power. One is artificial scarcity, make you think that there's less of this thing than that you need than there really is. And so they can do that by saying, oh, there's peak oil and that we're running out of oil. Neglecting the fact of the Cornell studies by Thomas Gold that says oil is abiotic and the when the well goes dry 100 years later, it's filled back up with oil.
Yeah, that's right.
And people settled off because they think it's empty and they think it's done. But then the people that buy it, no, it's going to just fill back up. It's like the pores on your skin. Like the crust of the earth is like the earth's skin, like our skin on our face. So I'm not saying that's absolute. I'm just saying they call it a fossil fuel. They drilled it at 20,000 feet. There's never been fossils found that deep in the earth. So just think about these terms that they have us using without even thinking about it. They have us parroting these terms, and it's really important to try to understand these things. What information is available on these topics, and where can we learn more? This whole green agenda is dreamt up way before any of the things that we've heard about it. So you can go back into Technocracy back in the 30s and 40s. You can bring it up through the 60s where they start to say, hey, you know, it'd be really great if we could convince everybody that we're running out of resources and we're running out of these raw materials. And how could we do that? Well, we could start to make everything, instead of making it to last, like you build something with quality, we can make everything junk so it only lasts a couple years. We can make these clothes that fall apart right away so they have to buy more. And basically, after World War I, this goes back to Bernays and Lippmann, they had to convince people to keep in this mentality that they're in a war economy, that they can just, you know, keep, you know, working for this stuff and using it up, because that's what wars do. They bring in a bunch of materials and they blow that up, and they bring in a bunch more materials and they blow that up, whether it's human or planes or ships or bombs or bullets or whatever. It's like, you know, a constant industrial process. So they wanted to keep America and the rest of the world in this war mentality where we're always using things up. So you can't be buying a pair of pants and wearing them for 20 years. You got to, you know, every couple, oh, here's a fashion. Fashion can lay on top of this. Now we got people buying stuff they don't need, and we got them buying it more often than they need to, not only because the stuff wears out because it's not made with quality, but because they have this mentality that they need new stuff even when they don't. They put all these layers together, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, the landfills are filling up and we're running out of everything, and we're running out of water that's being privatized by Nestle. And so they got us in a fear mode. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add to that. When we think of that, whether it's landfills and junk and the lack of quality, it seems like we have and you even mentioned I think you mentioned fashion trends there. We have this idea, it seems, that it's okay to – and I'll use a few examples here. It's okay to live the lifestyles we live with drugs that include caffeine and sugar in excessive amounts. It's okay to live the lifestyles we use where we use genetically modified products, or at the very least, very processed, very refined sugars and flours in the processed food that we consume. We can do that, but if we do that, when we become ill, it is not a byproduct of the lifestyle. It's simply a byproduct of that's just how life is. So here's a pill to cover up those effects from living that lifestyle. In the same way, it seems to be this idea of replacing your car every year, replacing your phone every year, replacing your clothes every time a trend changes. These are the same people that have that idea of conserving resources and wanting to protect the environment, but then they go and buy the new phone every single quarter, or they go buy the new phone every 6 months, or they even have plans now through phone companies where you're upgraded. And then the other one, yeah, you can recycle it back to the company. Most people just they throw this stuff out, whether it's phones, clothes, electronics. And you're right, things begin to break, things turn to junk. There's hardly any quality. People's lack of interest in their jobs evaporates. There's no customer service anymore, and it seems like the whole process is just about extracting any and all resources from the culture, almost like a parasite, and then relieving the host of that extraction and leaving the host population dried up with nothing left. I mean, I can take this in a variety of directions, but just as I'm sort of speaking off the cusp here, that's what it seems like to me. It seems like we're dealing with parasites, just to use an analogy of what these people are promoting and how the culture and how the society is being literally engineered on multiple levels.
Well, let me take it back to the beginning of what you said. The sugar and the GMOs, that means individuals have lost touch with what the purpose of food is. If the food is there to maintain our body and to give us energy, and you're putting in a bunch of junk, then that's kind of antithetical. Moving up to fashion and needing a new car and keeping up with the Joneses and stuff, it's like, let's stop for a second. What do you actually need? You need classics. Don't buy into the trends. Don't buy the wide leg pants or the skinny pants. Buy the classic trends that year or like decade after decade, those look like pants, you know, and you get them well made. Buy them from a company that gives you a lifetime warranty like L.L. Bean or Duluth Trading. There's companies out there that have really good customer service, make really good stuff. I'm not being paid by any of these companies. I'm just saying I'd rather spend a little bit more for something that'll last me 10, 20 years. And I do have clothes that I wear that are that old easily. Than something that's going to fall apart after a couple times in the wash that's made by slaves in another country that I don't want to support them being slaves and I don't want to buy those cheap clothes. So I don't have a lot, but what I do have, I try to have quality and maintain it and take care of stuff because I understand the value of a dollar. I appreciate, like, I would like to have a new car, but I drive a car from last century. One, because it's really cheap, it's easy to maintain, it's easy to get parts for, and it has very few computers in it. That's another thing I'm kind of like, you know, I like the skill of driving a car. I don't want driverless cars. I appreciate, you know, paying attention and doing one thing at a time. I'm not trying to like text and watch a movie and do all these things and travel at 65 miles an hour. So like I have realistic expectations and I'm not trying to like be taken care of by all this technology. But that brings you up to the last point you made, which is there is a term for what you're describing. It was created in 1952. By a woman who studied animals named Miriam Rothschild. She's the daughter of Lord Rothschild, who was also a zoologist and heir to the banking family, the Rothschilds. He was the addressee on the Balfour Declaration. I have a T-shirt that I designed where it's a picture of Lord Rothschild in 1901 on top of this giant tortoise, and he's leading it around. He's got this stick, and he's hanging it out in front of the tortoise's face, and it's got a piece of greenery on it. And I'm like, wow, this is how the bankers lead the world around with greenery. Like, it's a total metaphor for what his family did.
I like
but
that.
Going back up to 1952, Miriam Rothschild, she was watching these gulls in South Antarctica, and she sees some of these gulls wait for the other gulls to do some work and catch some food, and then they go over and plunder it. And she came up with a term. She called it intraspecific kleptoparasites of the same species, but plundering their production. And I was like, wow. That's what's going on here. They wait for us to do a bunch of work, and then they either tax it or steal it or whatever. But that's basically like it's not just human nature. It's in nature. And once you notice, oh, the world works like that in some ways sometimes, then you can learn to apply your intellect and your cognition to try to avoid that.
Yeah, and you remove consent from the system. So let's say that you're buying clothes. You don't have the necessary skills to make your own clothes. You don't have an initiative to learn how to make clothes, and I don't either. And you go buy clothes that maybe they're from a company where it is quality, and maybe there is some form of, quote, slave labor involved, which most of the items we purchase at stores that are very large stores like Walmart or Target, some of these big department stores, mostly everything is slave constructed, built, sewn in some capacity. But then you have companies that do make some quality items, and if there is an aspect of slave labor involved, to remove your consent from the system would be to purchase an item if you're going to, if you feel the necessity, if you feel the need to, from a company where you do get a more quality-based item. So you're not supporting by buying five pairs of pants a month because your other ones fall apart. You buy one pair and it lasts the entire year or multiple years. I mean, I have pants, all my entire wardrobe. I had some of this in high school. I bought maybe three shirts in the last 5 years. Honestly, it doesn't matter to me if it fits and it's functional, then it works. But my point is to withdraw consent from the system. So even when you go to the grocery store, and we're already finding this, Richard, this is another big subject I address often on the show. You find through boycotting and just simply writing letters and not purchasing products that moms and dads across the United States and even across the world have forced companies like Kellogg's and General Mills and Kraft to remove ingredients from their products because, well, they're not selling them with those ingredients in the final product. So just a few, really a minority, withdrawing consent from that system in particular relating to food, they have turned these monstrous entities into pandering little children that turn around and say, whoa, okay, if you're not going to buy it, what can we do to make you buy it? We'll take that ingredient. Okay, we'll take it out. Are you going to buy it now? Sure, I'll buy it. So that's what it seems like to me. We just have to withdraw consent from the system, and we already see that application working fabulously with the food industry. At least that's my perspective.
No, it works easier when you're dealing with those individual corporations and not the government as a whole, but it's a good model for trying to figure out how to withdraw your consent from the whole governmental model and the extortion of taxation to pay for wars that you have. You know, I got no problem with these people that they're dropping bombs on, you know, and they could be dropping bombs on us at any time. Like, you don't know what's going to go on with that. They're given a massive amounts of power. So let's figure out how to take that back. And what Gandhi did back in the day was he started teaching people, is like, look, we got to make our own clothes. We got to spin our own fabric. And he took it down to a very basic level. And I'm not saying that everyone needs to do this or has the time to do this. I'm just saying, like, if you really want to withdraw your consent, you grow some hemp in your yard. You take that, you make it into fiber, you weave it into cloth, you make your own clothes. And now you're independent. You got clothes that will last forever because hemp's a wonderful a thread. To make fabric from. It's really durable. And let's say maybe you don't want to do that. There's some place in the middle. You find your happy medium, what you can do at any given time in this system. And you apply the same thing to food. It's like we'd all like to avoid GMOs. And if you had the money to do so, even if you do have the money to do so, it's practically impossible to do because there's not enough organic farms yet to produce enough that would meet the demand. So you've got suppliers that think they're getting non-GMO, but they're really getting sold, getting pushed GMO products marked as non-GMO just because the supply and demand hasn't caught up yet. But what we're doing is it's not going to happen without us trying. You're not going to have all this without a little bit of struggle. And that's what we're going through now. I think this whole, the struggle of trying to get things labeled or, learning that, the Subway bread has yoga mat rubber and this sort of stuff in it.
It's that like yummy azo dicarbonamide, huh?
Yeah, you can't do anything about it till you know about it. And then once you know about it, hey, maybe some clever food babe or something does a little protest and she gets some people to change their minds. But maybe you don't need to be the food babe. Maybe you just need to write a letter or get the other people at the PTA at your kid's school or whatever. I'm just saying there's different avenues to be explored, but we're not going to explore any of these avenues of trying to withdraw our consent if we don't know that there's something we should withdraw our consent from. If you think that drones overseas are just being used to kill terrorists, you might not want to withdraw your consent. But then if you find out that 910 out of every 1,000 people killed are innocent civilians, women and children, then you might say, whoa, what is my tax dollars going toward? So it takes the knowledge that we put, we learn for ourselves, we create media, we share with other people, they learn for themselves, they verify it, they might find something different, they might see it's the same. And that this is like the only way that things get to happen.
Unfortunately, through that Stockholm syndrome, many people would justify the 900 plus men, women and children dying out of the 1,000 as some form of collateral damage. And that's justification because if we don't kill them there, they'll just grow up to be terrorists. So obviously you have that inverted reality. But
by bombing them, you're definitely making sure that they're going to grow up to oppose your way of life and your system because your system sucks from their perspective. Your system's raining down fire on them.
And that's the same perspective from the prison industrial complex, which is essentially a byproduct and a sidearm of big banks and corporations that launder drug money and bring drugs into the country, for which then you go to the jails that are owned by the big banks. It's cheap slave labor, especially the fact that minorities are, and blacks in particular, are highly incarcerated. It's a modern-day plantation. But in order to withdraw our consent from the system offers us a form of withdrawing our consent, and that is, maybe you could comment on this briefly, and that is protesting. We think protesting, we're doing something, we're holding up signs, we're taking action. But then, as you saw with the Occupy protests, I'll never forget this. I was reading a story, I think it was out west, it was in San Francisco, I can't recall, where these protesters were protesting the bank. It was the SunTrust, and then they got a donation from somebody that wanted to help their cause. It was like $2,400 or something. And they then deposited the money in the bank they were protesting to shut down. And it's that kind of attitude. I mean, the people that think they protest GMOs and then go to McDonald's for lunch and discuss the protest. Just that's my point, though. Maybe you could comment on protesting.
Well, it even sounds ironic when you say it. Like it's awful. Like, so I would just explain it like this. I'm going to use a generalization. This doesn't apply to every specific instance, but this is the generalization that I notice. Protests are usually a plot to get well-meaning people to waste their time, money, energy, and attention. and it's done by the people that you'd usually be protesting against. So while you're out there doing this protest, your time, your money, your attention, your energy is being worn down, worn down, worn down until you have to give up and go back to work or change and do something else with your life because you're not getting through. And I knew Occupy was rigged from the moment that it started in the winter. Because if there's anything you've learned through looking at world history, military history, is you do not invade in the winter. It didn't work for any number of Napoleon. It didn't work for Germany against Russia. Like, it's not something you do. You don't go outside and try to live in tents through a northeast winter. You don't do it. If Occupy was a serious, organized group of people trying to do the thing that they're trying to do, they start in the spring, right? When did Occupy start? Didn't it start like in the fall?
The fall months, yes.
It was like set up. It was set up for failure right there. And right there, I said, these people are going to be so disappointed. Because you see all this well-meaning energy. These people want change. They want something done.
It's a way to divert that energy.
They don't know that they need to sit at home and develop themselves. They need to sit at home and read these books that these other people don't want you to read. You know? And I'll break it down for you like just like in a two-minute, splash page of the mind, right? It's like, this is all we need to do to take back our power, right? And the people and the authorities that stole our power in the first place through deception, they are powerless to stop us. But if you go out and follow their lead and get in these protests, which, Soros has been overthrowing countries around the world with this tactic. He took the tactics of this guy from Boston. His name's Gene Sharp. If you want the short and quick on his whole life story, you watch this documentary called How to Start a Revolution. Gene Sharp figured out how to go into these totalitarian regimes and these communist regimes and have the people rise up and totally do a 180 on the whole thing. And then Soros is like, what if I took Gene Sharp's techniques and applied them to legitimate democracies? Oh, geez. And so you have to ask yourself, what is the game being played? Who are the rulers? How are they actually ruling over us? And then how can we take back our power? And that's it. But it's not going to be done through protesting. It's not going to be done through violence. It's not going to be done through, trying to rise up. It's going to be done through you sitting at home, likely at home or library or someplace else, and developing your mind and understanding the history that led us here. I mean, that's what you do all the time, Ryan, right?
That's
right. I don't see you out. Have you been out protesting this week?
No protesting. I didn't have a cry-in. Nope. I don't need Play-Doh or coloring books to help me as some universities are offering.
You got a safety pin to hold your diaper up, man?
Yep.
Like, this is not something that would ever be on my radar to go out and protest. Like, I had a close association to 9/11. I lost people I worked with in it. I have a great interest in trying to figure out what's going on with that whole situation and how the multi-layers of deception worked and the government war games and the insider trading and all these different things. And I did go to Ground Zero once on 9/11, but I didn't go there to protest. I went there to film the dynamic between these protesters and the cops and what came of it? What came of all that energy invested into that? Nothing. But if I stay home on a weekend when they're all down there doing that, I can learn my way out of the lies and deception that have been put out there by the myth makers who make the 9/11 Commission report. I could read a book like The Hidden History of 9/11 by Professor Paul Zaremba from the University of New York. And that's a much better investment of my time because that knowledge that I gain, those insights I get from reading a good book like that, I have for the rest of my life. And I don't get that from protesting.
When you think about protesting, too, most of us tend to think we have this societal image that a protest is people holding signs and maybe screaming someone on a bullhorn. But protesting, by definition, is really just the expression of disapproval for or an objection of something or of someone. That's a protest, and you can do that.
Yeah, withdrawing our consent. Yeah, so I protest in a different way. I don't do it with George Soros manufactured signs and George Soros paid buses and, all these different things. It's like it's in the Podesta emails. You can see the attachments that Soros – like they even say something. We would never do this except to please Soros. Those are quotes from the emails. They have the attachments and the plans in the emails. For people to be like, these are all legitimate movements, I'm like, no. You need to read some more before you go spewing your ignorance.
Well, yeah, you saw these collar revolutions around the world. The same type of money and the same agenda from Soros directly was pumped into the Ferguson riots. It was pumped into the Trayvon Martin protests. I lived right down the street at the time during those protests in Florida. And now it's the same protests that are happening across the country after the U.S. presidential election, where you have dozens of cities simultaneously, these groups spawn out of nowhere with the same slogans, the same signs, the same rhetoric, and they begin protesting. And I remember even reading, I was reading something the other day about, it's the same black bloc anarchist groups that infiltrated the Occupy movement that are initiating some of these protests, and that comes from Open Society and George Soros, and all of this is funded. Meanwhile, these are the same people, and I don't support Donald Trump, but these are the same people that said, well, Donald Trump, he's not going to accept the results of the election. I can't believe somebody would say that. And then they're the ones out protesting, breaking windows and tipping cars over and blocking interstates. And then, and this is really my question, I wanted you to comment on that, but then also on the absolute incredible nature of even Ivy League universities. I don't know if you read much about this. This was at Yale University.
Calling off midterms. They called off midterms.
Yeah. They're having cry-ins, and they're offering students tissues, hot chocolate, puppy dogs, coloring books, and Play-Doh. And this is at the University of Michigan, University of New York, Columbia University of New York, Yale, Cornell, big universities. They're offering kids hot chocolate and canceling exams. What does this say about the not just the future of America, but as the generation that is growing up that will take lead in the world in the next few decades?
Well, then they're not going to take lead. You can't take a lead when you have extended adolescence like that. They're going to continue to expect to be coddled. Baby boomers will pass out. Then we'll be in charge at much older age than we're supposed to be in charge. And then the generation that's coming up underneath them, that's going to have to learn about all this stuff and be self-reliant because their parents couldn't take care of anything. That's where those generations are headed. Oh, you know, yeah, tough day at school today. Well, I got to call off work because somebody said words I don't like and I heard them in my ears and they're responsible for my feelings. So I'm a victim. I can't do anything about it. So let me just take a step back because you were talking about the anarchists out there and stuff like that. I think that's another big misnomer out there because they're like, no, these aren't anarchists. These are people who are violent. These are people without any understanding of even like the concept of what anarchy could be. And, you know, anarchy comes from, ancient languages. It means without rulers. It's anarchy is a noun. It's a theory that holds that all forms of government authority are unnecessary and undesirable. And it's advocating a society based on voluntary cooperation and free association. So all these things that we've grown up with, hearing, oh, the anarchists, they're violent and they hide their faces and do all this stuff. It's like anarchy is not chaos. It is not lawlessness. It is based upon the principle of self-ownership. Oh, wait, self-ownership? No one told you about that? Because you thought anarchy, that's what everyone's told. Everyone, oh, the anarchists, they're out there doing all the violence. Look, no. The reason that you have this false idea of what that is because they don't want you to know about self-ownership, because self-ownership means you have self-responsibility for your own thoughts, your own actions. So if someone says some mean words, well, sticks and stones, dude, they're not, you know, unless you're breaking my bones, sticks and stones, those words don't hurt me. But that doesn't apply to this generation that you just described that gets a day off from Yale and gets their midterms canceled because, oh, Trump trauma or whatever, right? So it's like, from a definitional standpoint, anarchists are peaceful people who reject initiated aggression against anyone without exception. What does that mean? It means you are against taxes because your taxes are being used to kill innocent people or not so innocent people on the other side of the world. But regardless of what they're doing over there, they're not coming into contact with me. I got no beef with them. So don't extort money from me to pay for them, right? So there's all these concepts that were, you know, all these guys, yeah, those people on TV, they're irrational. They're violent, they're destructive, they're not creative, they got misspent energy, but they put this label on there, and that label that they put on there might actually be the solution to your individual freedom. But as long as we're like, you know, all out there just stimulus and reaction, we're not going to get to that. And this other thing about this whole, the whole safety pin, I mean, they don't even realize like the double meaning of that. It's like, oh, you got your safe spaces. We see that as something used to hold diapers together, right? That means you got extended adolescence. That means you need extra coddling. You can't carry your own weight. You're not self-responsible. That I don't want to hang out with people who aren't self-responsible, who don't have self-ownership, who think that they're a slave, that every couple years they got to vote for a new master and everything will be okay. I'm for autonomy. And in the ancient Hindu, they called it Swaraj. This is something that Gandhi also talked about, because you can't be a free person and think you're a slave at the same time. So if you're not, you know, espousing a life of self-reliance and self-ownership and self-responsibility, you're going to be bought and sold by these people who control you through A, your thoughts, and B, your physical actions, because you don't have any thoughts worth having. And these are the types of people that when any of these magnetic opportunities come up, it's like, oh, they're all too happy to go out and protest. And we think, oh, yeah, there's a bunch of well-meaning people out there protesting. But who organized it? Who paid for the signs? Who paid for the buses? How did that all go on? So there's one group of people that are saying, hey, Hegelian dialectic, we can just create this situation and people will flock in. And in the absence of them being organized and bringing their own signs, we have a bunch of signs that just happen to match the signs in the back of John Podesta's office. Right? Like, you can go through some of these pictures and be like, the signs in this protest are identical to this guy's campaign office, or, you know, other people that Project Veritas has caught in the background. And so there's all these different layers, but you're never going to see them if you think you already have the right answer because you listen to CNN or MSNBC or Fox News or whoever. It's like, if you're getting your information from a news outlet that has a political stance, you're getting snowed. You're going through life with one eye open and you got a muddy lens in front of it. It's like you need both eyes open. Look at all this stuff. Look at what's going on. Then you can see the game that they're playing with people. It's like I could tell people how they voted just by what newspapers or what TV news they watch. And that's like a 95% accuracy. That shouldn't be right, you know, but it is right now.
TragedyandHope.com. That is the website of our guest this evening, Richard Grove. I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I wish that we had a bit more time. I would hope that you can join us again sometime on the broadcast. What we're going to do is take a very, very brief pause for a short break, come back, and then I'd like to give you the final 5 minutes or so to talk about your work in particular, the videos, the radio, the websites, and all the other things that you do. We'll be right back. You are listening to The Secret Teachings. I'm Ryan Gable, Richard Grove, our guest.
Want to become an initiate of The Secret Teachings? Did you miss an episode, or do you prefer to listen during the day rather than late at night? Subscribe to The Secret Teachings radio program and get access to our full archive of high-quality, streamable, and downloadable shows, our insider video vault, and more. Whether you are a novice or master, subscribe to The Secret Teachings and empower yourself. For more information, you can visit thesecretteachings.info.
Hello, my friends. You're listening to The Secret Teachings, and I'm Dr. Leonard Coldwell, the author of the mega bestseller, The Only Answer to Cancer, and 22 other mega bestsellers that are available in 7 different languages. My videos have been watched over 1 billion times. My radio show has 2.9 million listeners, and I am one of the greatest fans of The Secret Teachings and Ryan, my dear friend. And it is so important that you really listen and support this show, because this is a show that brings you the truth and solutions, and there is no fear, there are no doubts, and you hear the truth.
There are plenty of ways to help support the Secret Teachings radio program so that I can continue to bring you one of the most unique and straightforward perspectives on the airwaves. Whether purchasing one of my 3 books in digital, softback, or hardback from the website, or anywhere else books are sold worldwide, or by donating a few dollars through PayPal, all contributions help in growing this show, which in turn helps you by providing important resources and information in one concise location. Visit www.thesecretteachings.info to find my books, free recommendations on health, and click the PayPal donation button to contribute to one of the last true forms of independent free thought. That's www.thesecretteachings.info.
Hi, this is John Perkins. I'm the author of The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, as well as a number of other books. My website is johnperkins.org, and you are listening to The Secret Teachings with Ryan Gable.
In an amazing follow-up to his first book, author, researcher, and radio host of The Secret Teachings, Ryan Gable, has put together another massive encyclopedia of ancient and modern mysteries. Although not mandatory, Ryan's first book, The Grand Illusion, is key to understanding who controls the world and how. The Persistent Illusion explores why. In The Persistent Illusion, Ryan recaps the nature of reality and hidden history of mankind. A background on ancient holy days is provided to make us aware of the influence of certain symbols, and also rituals that we participate in daily. The book exposes global practices of genocide and eugenics conducted by mega-wealthy elitists to stun and strip the willpower and soul from humanity. Are these globalists human, alien, or possessed? Ryan proposes that the global transhumanism eugenics genocide agenda may be a phase within a more complex, already underway alien invasion of Earth. The persistent illusion is what journalist and best-selling author Jim Mars calls an extraordinary compendium of information and a must-have for both the newly awakened and the savviest of researchers. You can find this book by visiting www.thesecretteachings.info or searching The Persistent Illusion on Amazon.com.
Thank you, Ryan. And by the way, everyone listening, I would encourage you to go get a copy of Ryan's book, The Persistent Illusion, okay? It's lengthy, but it's got all the ammunition you need to start figuring out what's really going on in the world.
This is one of the best discussions I've been on in a long time. You guys are right on it.
Howdy. This is Joe Mars, and you're listening to The Secret Teachings.
We are back live this evening. I'm Ryan Gable. Richard Grove, our guest, in this shortened two-hour edition of The Secret Teachings. We are live every Saturday, Sunday, and Wednesday, 12 a.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific. Adjust accordingly to your time zone around the world as we air worldwide. Our website, www.thesecretteachings.info. Please go there, become a member, subscribe today to get access to our full show archive, where you can download and stream all of our past shows with great guests, timeless subjects, ancient mysteries, and modern corruption. You also get access to our insider video vault. Even without a subscription, you can, of course, listen live. You can listen to the next morning re-airs of the broadcast and find selected show clips on our YouTube page, and you can find YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, all of our social media linked up on the website www.thesecretteachings.info. You'll also find a biography, photograph, and links to our guests' information, Richard Grove, tragedyandhope.com. Richard, it's been a pleasure this evening. You can take the next couple of minutes to really speak to the work that you do, and maybe we can have you back on sometime in the near future.
Well, Ryan, I want to thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasant conversation. I look forward to being able to chat again. And I've been very impressed with the work of yours that I've reviewed. It wasn't like, oh, I got to do the homework and like see who this guy. I was actually interested in listening to your stuff and watching your stuff before you even invited me. So that was very synergistic. And especially with the recent video you did on the Podesta emails. Like, I had looked into this. I'm not an expert, but I looked into it pretty deeply, and I was still able to learn a lot from your presentation. And your presentation was off the cuff, so I recommend that to your listeners, too. You can put a link in the show notes. My website is tragedyandhope.com. It's named after a 1966 history book that they destroyed the plates, and they destroyed the plates so it couldn't be replicated, so you couldn't read it. And it's like a censored book of U.S. history that kind of gives you a overarching perspective, if you pardon that Masonic reference. It's an overarching perspective on how globalism works, how the New World Order works. It's written by a very credible professor that taught at Georgetown University, was actually the mentor of Bill Clinton. I'm not saying he's a good guy. I'm just saying that the information in the book is very credible and enlightening as far as the things that they're occulting from us or hiding from us. I produce a podcast called The Peace Revolution. It's found on Tragedy and Hope's front page. Midway down, you'll see all these green boxes, green squares that are all the covers for each episode, or you can find it under the audio tab. I have a book project going on right now. You can find it at it's probably posted on the front page of the site. But I'm doing an Indiegogo fundraiser, so it's a book project called The Truth About the Rothschilds, and what I did was I got like about 40 of the autobiographies and biographies on the Rothschild banking dynasty and the family and the different individuals in it, and then I crafted a resource manual to tell people, like, here's what exists, here's where you can find it, all these juicy facts that are usually disparate and a little talked about all in one place. And I've got a film project going on called The Future of Freedom. And you can find links to the recent interviews I've done for that project. And so I just try to keep busy, and all the things I learn, I just reflect out in these different forms of media that I produce, whether it's a book or a video or a podcast episode, and those different outlets let me convey all the things that I'm doing to grow in the light direction out to the audience.
And the listeners want to go to tragedyandhope.com to find out more, correct?
Yeah, you can go to tragedyandhope.com, or if you want to be a patron, you can subscribe on Tragedy and Hope, but there's also, I have a Patreon site, so it's Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, .com/ Tragedy and Hope, if you'd like to be a patron of my art.
Excellent, Richard. Thank you so much. This has been insightful, and I appreciate the kind words towards my work as well. If you could stick with me for just one moment off air so that we could talk, I'll go ahead and wind down the broadcast and bring up the music. Richard Grove, our guest this evening. You are listening to the Secret Teachings radio broadcast. Do the research, do the math, stop letting people tell you what to think, including myself, and connect the dots between seemingly unconnected people, places, and events, and the world that seems so complex will hopefully begin to make sense. We will be back Saturday and Sunday live, 12 a.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific, for the full 3 hours. The reason we did not hit that 3-hour mark this evening is because I am working on a fourth book called the working title, Technological Elixir. And we will be discussing more of that in detail on some upcoming shows relating to artificial intelligence and the philosophical viewpoints of theology, science, mythology, symbolism, and the technological progression of our current age. Again, I'm Ryan Gable. This is The Secret Teachings. Visit our website to subscribe and donate to support the work that I do. That's www.thesecretteachings.info. Namaste.
Certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me.